Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The government-sponsored film Confucius opened across China this weekend, knocking Avatar out of theaters. The big-budget biopic of the philosopher who lived 2,500 years ago is a kind of hymn of praise to Confucius. You can hear the music from the film's trailer behind me right now. Under Mao, Confucius was definitely out of favor in China, officially reviled. Now the Chinese Communist Party is all warmth toward Confucianism and the great sage. This hour, On Point, we'll ask why, as we look at Confucius, his teachings, and his new place in contemporary China. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the return of Confucius in China? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Du Wei Ming, professor of Chinese history and philosophy and Confucian studies at Harvard University. He spent the last 6 months in China, where he is starting the Institute for Advanced Humanistic Studies at Peking University. He's written extensively on Confucius. Professor Du, welcome, and thank you so much for being here.
I'm very pleased to be here.
So Confucius was not at all popular in China, certainly not with Mao Zedong back in the time of the Cultural Revolution. But today in China, do you see a resurgence? Is it obvious that Confucius is back?
It was popular in the negative sense, because it was always a reference as an object of attack.
But, even during Mao's time.
Even during Mao's time. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a major campaign against Lin Biao and Confucius. Everybody mm-hmm. was surprised mm-hmm. why it's still relevant. I was in China in 1980 for a year. Mm-hmm. And in 1985, I actually gave a lecture course at Peking University mm-hmm. on Confucian philosophy. And since then, there's a major upsurge of interest in Confucianism, not only in the academic community, but in the mass media, even in the business community, not to mention the scholarly community.
There are many interpretations about that upsurge in interest, and we'll talk about them. There
sure.
are some who say it's the Communist Party using Confucianism to find
sure.
credibility.
Sure.
Others, there's been a lot of talk about China looking for a new moral compass, and maybe Confucius. What's your interpretation of the resurgence of interest in Confucius?
I think all you mentioned turned out to be true, but we need to look at as a very complex phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
It has been argued that Confucianism is the longest and perhaps the most influential humanistic and spiritual tradition in human history. Confucius was born 551 BC. His birthday, September 28th, is really celebrated in Taiwan and other areas as the Teacher's Day. So
the tradition, Teacher's
the
Day.
Teacher's
the
Day.
The Teacher.
The
yeah.
Teacher's Day.
Right.
And for a long time, I think Confucianism was somewhat attacked and then marginalized since the mid-19th century because of the impact of the West.
Mm-hmm.
Since the so-called May 4th of 1919, it was severely attacked as incapable of responding to the challenge of the West and of modernization.
It was seen as having held China back, made China vulnerable to imperialistic aggression.
That's absolutely right. But at the same time, there was very strong patriotism, the belief that China eventually will prevail, but the basis was to develop Western ideas such mm-hmm. as science and democracy at the expense of the Confucian tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But in the last 30 years in particular, Confucianism resurfaced in China as a very important reference, not only for the intellectual community, but for people in general. The government, I think, decided to take a more positive view towards Confucianism. By the way, the official ideology in the government is still socialist. So
yes, but what that means in China, it's hard
totally
to say.
Different.
It essentially means Communist Party power, and the government seems to be vigorously embracing Confucianism there, sponsoring Confucius Institutes all over the world now as
yeah.
kind of outposts of Chinese teaching, language teaching, and cultural teaching.
Right. But I think the background is interesting. The government never took the initiative of trying to revive Confucianism. It was a response to a very popular, very pervasive upsurge of interest. I think it may have something to do with China's quest for a new cultural identity. With the view to the future, I think it's important to note that an estimated of 10 million children in China now can recite part of the four books. Children age 8 to 13.
That means it's being taught in the public schools?
Not through government sponsorship, but by private citizens, especially parents. And a book published by Yu Dan, a scholar, actually became the bestseller all through Chinese history. More than 10 million, according to one account.
This is the sort of a new age interpretation of Confucius, big seller in China.
Yes.
Yu Dan, who has become a Beijing professor, but become a very sort of popular figure.
She was a Peking professor, and then she became interested in doing that through the public channels. I think it's interesting to note, too, that many TV stations now talk about Confucianism by inviting some of the prominent scholars, the stories, the classics, and the implications.
And now we've got this big movie opening all over China, sort of bumping Avatar out of the theaters.
It's a bit controversial, though.
Well, yes, I know. Avatar was very popular. All Chinese are happy to see it go, to see a kind of a costume drama about Confucius.
Sure.
It might be helpful to take a moment here to think about, to talk about what Confucianism is, what it means. I think the Westerners look, and it's not clear if it's a philosophy or a religion. Mm-hmm. We associate ideas like order, harmony, respect for authority and hierarchy with Confucianism.
Yes.
How do you describe or define Confucianism's core?
It's a way of life. It's a celebration of life in particular, involvement in the world here and now, with no reference to a holy other, such as the kingdom of God or the pure land outside of the world here and now. It's an ethic with emphasis on some of the really fascinating ideas, for example, reciprocity. But it's stated in the negative. Do not do to others what you would not want others to do to you, which is more Jewish than Christian. At the same time, it also considered humanity or love not as universal love in the abstract sense, but in the concrete sense. So when Confucius asked, what about paying viciousness with kindness? He responded, how are you going to treat kindness? So his suggestion is to respond to viciousness with justice, to respond kindness with kindness. So a kind of nuanced ethics for the way of life. But this is also, as you pointed out, a political ideology. Throughout Chinese history, it became extremely dominant form of organizing government. But it also regulated the way of life from the elite to the populace as a whole.
I think a lot of people will see it as almost tailor-made for an autocratic regime, for the Communist Party. Respect for hierarchy, respect for authority, order and harmony is prized, which, of course, we know the Communist Party, any ruler in Beijing, needs, wants order and harmony.
Absolutely. Genetically, I mean, historically, it seems that Confucianism evolved out of an agriculture-based economy, family-centered social structure, and paternalism, which could turn out to be authoritarian. Mm-hmm. But I think it is extremely difficult to argue that the rise of communism or Maoism had anything to do with the positive contributions of Confucianism, because they were totally committed to a kind of anti-Confucian, Marxist-Leninist approach with emphasis on class struggle. One of the great ideas in the Confucian tradition, of course, is harmony. And harmony is not sameness, which means the idea of allowing differences not only to exist but to celebrate. So harmony is a mixture of differences.
But it can be used to justify authoritarianism or oppression even. Don't disrupt the harmony, even if you're at the bottom of the heap.
But it's important also to know the Confucian spirit of protest. Mm-hmm. For example, harmony is not uniformity. If the government wants to use harmony as a substitute for uniformity, then the critical spirit, for example, all kinds of examples. In traditional China, the idea that in Chinese cuisine, you have to have many spices. In painting, you have to have many colors. And of course, in music, the word harmony comes from music, you have to have many different instruments. Now, to say the government wants to use it for certain kind of purposes like stability and so forth is a correct description, but it's superficial and sometimes rather one-sided. I'll give you an example. We don't want to reduce Christianity to Catholicism or reduce to Catholicism to the Vatican or reduce Vatican to the infallibility of the Pope. So the Pope is interested in an overall mechanism in not necessarily control, but in keeping with all the Christians. The Confucian tradition, which influenced the development of the government, once the government became Confucianized, the government wanted to use Confucianism as a moral code for social stability and so forth. But it's undeniable that Confucianism was male-oriented, historically speaking, hierarchical, authoritarian. But Confucianism also has been going through a very major transformation in the last 50 years.
Du Weiming, please stand by. We have to take a short break right here. Great. Behind us, more music from the new film, just out at the expense of Avatar. We're looking at the comeback of Confucius in China. Can you believe we're talking again about Confucius in the 21st century? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the comeback of Confucius in China and the Chinese Communist Party's drive to embrace the great sage and Confucian values. The big biopic opening in thousands of theaters across China this weekend. Theaters just emptied of Avatar, which was booted out to make way. It's a big costume drama, historical drama about the life of Confucius that's headed in over this past weekend. Here from the state-run Chinese television network CCTV, a summary, a little bit, of the new film.
The two-hour film traces the transformation of Confucius from an ordinary bookkeeper to a philosopher and sage. It reflects his life from the age of 51 to his death at 73, featuring some major events during the sage's enlightened journey. These include his efforts to weaken the power of aristocrats to strengthening the dignity of the king.
A news report from China on the big new film Confucius in theaters there this weekend. And Confucius and Confucianism back in many ways in China. I've been joined by Professor Du Weiming. He's professor of Chinese history and philosophy and Confucian studies at Harvard University. Just been setting up a new institute at Peking University. He's written extensively about Confucius. We'll hear more voices in just a moment, but we've got questions for you, Du Weiming. First to Stanley in Lisbon, New Hampshire. Stanley, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, my understanding of Confucianism is that it was very difficult to achieve by the common man, and it was a very sort of austere way of life, and that gave rise to Taoism, which was more attainable for the everyday man. And I just, if you could maybe, if I'm explain something about the difference between Taoism and Confucianism.
Absolutely, Stanley, and thank you for your call. Du Weiming, Confucianism has not always been the dominant philosophy in China. It sort of waxed and waned in different centuries. Sure. What about the relationship between Confucianism, Taoism, Buddhism?
Yes. I think Confucianism, as the flowing stream, manages to enter into all kinds of dialogical relationships with major currents of thought in China in the classical period, Taoism, legalism, and Moism, then later Buddhism, and right now, of course, the challenge of the modern West. In fact, many scholars, such as Li Zehou, talks about a characteristic of the Chinese cultivated person as a combination of Confucianism and Taoism. Taoism is very important in understanding the relationship between human beings and nature, and the idea of freedom, self-expression, with no concern for the government. And yet, inevitably, we are involved in the world here now. Mm-hmm. So Confucianism has become an important ethics for responsibility ethics for the inculcation of virtues and also ethics of care. So I would disagree with your general sense of Confucianism as a way of learning to be human. It's very demanding, therefore it's difficult to achieve it. I think the Confucian tradition is very much linked to our proper way of living at all levels, not only the elite level, but the popular level as well.
So when Stanley's perception is, he thinks about the ritual and hierarchy, and it sounds like something for elites.
Not just for elites. I think if you look at the level of populace, if you broaden the scope of Confucianism, Confucianism is not just Chinese. It's Vietnamese, it's Korean.
Japanese.
It's Japanese, yeah. So in that sense, ritual, you know, as Professor Herbert Fingerett, an American scholar, has noted, it's a proper way of living. It's a civility. This is a proper way of translating it. Civility, in the sense, it's civilized rather than barbaric. It's civil rather than official. It's civil rather than military.
And what about the sense that many Chinese, certainly Mao Zedong, had in the 20th century, that Confucianism had led to a kind of rigidity in Chinese culture that made it weak?
Well, China was weak, first of all, militarily, and then China failed to respond economically to the challenge of the West and institutionally. So eventually the Chinese intellectuals probe into their own tradition, believe that Confucianism as a cultural identity probably was outmoded. But right now it's an upsurge of new interest because China is economically strong, politically more audible. So now the question, what is Chinese message for the world? It's understandable that one of the most important strands of thought, both in the institutional level and also in terms of popular belief, resurface as an important resource for cultural identity.
And in your work in Beijing with the Advanced Humanistic Studies Institute there, are you looking to help revive Confucianism, to promote the teaching of Confucianism?
That's not right in the precise sense, because the Humanistic Institute is related to not just humanities, history, literature, and philosophy, but people who are humanistically concerned. One of the things I wanted to do is critique of the Confucian tradition. On the other hand, I also would like to see whether the Confucian tradition as a humanistic resource can sympathetically understand the modern West in terms of Enlightenment mentality and also to become a critique of modernity.
So through a Confucianist prism.
Yes, and a humanistic vision. I think in this sense, I believe, this is a personal belief, that many of the great currents of thought that emerge in the West, such as environmentalism, feminism, even postmodernism, deconstructionism, and cultural pluralism, all these are important resources for the modern Confucian to learn to become an integral part of the modern world.
To maybe absorb those. Du Weiming, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from New York, Xudong Chang. He's professor of East Asian Studies and Comparative Literature at NYU. Xudong Chang, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Hello, Tom.
Sorry. So how would you describe what's going on with this apparent resurgence of Confucianism? Is this from the grassroots? Is this Chinese tradition reasserting itself? Is it being promoted by the Chinese government, the Communist Party? What's going on with this resurgence?
It's very complicated. It's I would say a little bit both, but also I would like to throw in intellectuals, the universities. And this is a very interesting dynamic. But I want to start with this, general sort of discomfort with the news that Confucianism is coming back. I think this discomfort is even experienced within China. I guess when you mention Confucianism, I think the people usually, it's a knee-jerk reaction to think about two incompatibilities. One is that Confucianism is not compatible with modernity, enlightenment, or scientific rationality. That's why Confucianism was refuted by the Enlightenment intellectuals during the May 4th era. But I think that's a simplistic view of what happened historically. The other incompatible is because it's authoritarian nature, it's incompatible with democracy, individualism, freedom, and so on and so forth. I think there's also a misperception there. So briefly, I want to say this. I think Confucianism, Wei Ming already explained to some extent what Confucianism is. I think we should sort of put some emphasis on the fact that Confucianism is first and foremost about self-cultivation. So Confucius himself was a commoner, as one of your listeners just pointed out. And he lived in an age of the disintegration of imperial order. So if Confucianism was a way to pursue order or reason or truth, it was firstly done in the middle of chaos.
There was a need for some order there.
Exactly. But but the order is not order per se, but a kind of a new order that is based on the broader participation of those highly motivated, self-guiding, learned commoners. So this, to some extent, is historical Confucianism. And that, I think, has something to do with our understanding of the function of Confucianism in today's China. Order, I think, is not necessarily in the narrow sense of law and order, what the state wants, what the party wants, but rather a general sort of a new ethical, social, cultural, political order, identity, sense of home, of belonging, meaning, and a value system, all these things. But it has to be done through a broader participation and through learning, knowledge, and a sense of dignity and a purpose.
Do you see Confucianism becoming a kind of state ideology in China? And do you see its revival as a state-sponsored effort?
I don't think so. That's not what I see. The state could be a sponsor. Could see something that is available in Confucianism to its own agenda, but to Confucian, the return of Confucianism in a broad sense, I think it's too complicated for any sector of today's China to monopolize or to claim. It's just too broad.
But it seems almost tailor-made for a country run by a communist party because of its emphasis, as Dui Ming was saying, on hierarchy and
yes
kind of
and
authoritarian
no.
tint.
Yeah, it's a good point, but yes and no. I think Confucianism, the perception is it's conservative, it's very hierarchical, paternalistic.
Of course, Mao taught us this, right? I mean, this is partly, this perception is in part promoted by most of a century of Chinese thinking.
Right. In this sense, Mao is a disciple of the larger modern Chinese intellectual political tradition called the Chinese Enlightenment. But the May 4th intellectuals, the forerunners of this Enlightenment movement, I think they were actually more careful in distinguishing a Confucian tradition, which is redeemable, or there are positive traits in it, from a Confucian orthodoxy. The orthodoxy, dogma, is bad, is something to be attacked. Whereas the broader Confucian tradition is something to be renegotiated into modernity, into the construction of modern Chinese society and the culture. And that positive side, I would emphasize this, because Confucian emphasis on self-cultivation and the notion of mandate of the heaven, it actually points out its self-positioning is the guardian of the way, but by implication, whoever loses the way needs to be replaced by force if necessary.
Which could be a kind of risk factor for a party that's very large and in charge in China. Xu Dongcheng, if you'd stand by for just a moment, I want to put a question to Dui Ming with me in the studio here. Everybody's watching China rise economically, watching its global power expand. It was Maoism. Now it's not, really. So Dui Ming, is Confucianism going to be the kind of a philosophical offering that China brings to the world as it spreads its wings? It's certainly, it's called its outposts, and there are scores of them now around the world for teaching Confucius Institutes.
I think in a way, Confucianism is going to emerge as a very important humanistic and spiritual resources for China's search for identity, cultural identity in particular. The government is only part of the player. We need to take into consideration the mass media, even the business community. You know, more than 2,000 business leaders were trained by the Department of Philosophy at Peking University to know more about Confucianism. Certainly the social movements as well. I think Xu Dong's overall assessment of Confucianism, I think I agree almost with every aspect of his statement, with exception of the very first part, that the tradition is not compatible with democracy, with science, with, let's say, feminist ideas of egalitarian and so forth. If you look at the tradition as a transforming process, it learned so much ever since the May 4th period from the West. Some of the best Confucian scholars, such as Liang Shuming, Mo Zhongshan, they're all committed to these great Western ideas. But right now, the Confucian tradition, as it reasserts itself, begin to be critical of the Enlightenment. Critical of...
Critical of the sort of heart of Western thought.
I wouldn't say heart of Western thought.
Well, certainly in the modern era, the Enlightenment is the baseline.
Sure. But I think, as I pointed out, some great Western thinkers, contemporary thinkers in the feminist, in environmental, and also in cultural pluralistic movements begin to question whether the Enlightenment is the philosophy that will guide humanity to the 21st century. It is in this sense that, let me just say, two sets of core values that are now being debated. Emphasis on liberty is terrific, but how about justice? Emphasis on legality, how about civility? Emphasis on human rights, but of course human responsibility. The dignity of the individual, hopefully it's not isolated individual, and a harmonious society. Not to mention the whole way of learning to be human. Can you learn to be human in the 21st century without reference to religion on the one hand and nature on the other? For example, Xu Dong talked about the incompatibility of Confucianism to many of the great Enlightenment ideas, but that's true with Christianity. That's true with Buddhism. And yet these traditions become important resources for self-understanding, for social harmony. So I think Confucianism may play this kind of role, especially Confucianism is part of the lived world here now, and it wants to transform the world from within. That's one of the reasons it has become so much immersed with politics, for both the positive and negative reasons. If I want to single out one reason for the resurface of Confucianism, it's the negative consequences of market economy, which has now turned into a kind of market society.
In China, in particular.
In particular. Every aspect.
So raw. So well, it has
so
been.
Competitive.
Yes.
Rugged individualism. Mm. I think a kind of market society is disastrous if the academic community, even religion, has been marketized. Then even some of the basic values that we all cherish, such as trust, is being eroded.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the comeback of Confucius in China and the Chinese Communist Party's drive to embrace the great sage and Confucian values. I've been joined in this hour by Du Wei Ming, a professor at Harvard University and also heading up the Institute for Advanced Humanistic Studies at Peking University, back just a couple days ago from Beijing. He joins me in the studio. From New York, we've been joined by Xu Dong Chang. He is professor of East Asian Studies and Comparative Literature at NYU, author of Post-Socialism and Cultural Politics, The Last Decade of China's 20th Century. One more voice I want to bring into the conversation now from Claremont, California. We're joined by Minqing Pei. He's a senior associate in the China program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's author of China's Trapped Transition. Minqing Pei, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
What do you see going on in the resurgence of Confucianism that we're seeing in China and with China's encouragement around the world?
Well, I see several things. There is an element of spontaneous search for cultural values from within Chinese society, but there is also a quite artificial and politically motivated campaign by the government to fill an ideological vacuum in China.
And why choose Confucianism to fill that vacuum?
Well, if you look at Chinese intellectual history, Confucius is clearly a giant. And if you want to fill the void, you are much better off to find something or somebody of the caliber of Confucius.
So Confucius is huge in Chinese history, but is Confucianism at heart? Does it line up with the Chinese Communist Party's goals, aspirations, what they need as a power?
Well, the Communist Party came into existence, if we recall, by denouncing Confucianism. May 4th Movement mm-hmm. In 1919 gave birth to the Chinese Communist Party, and Confucius was a target in that cultural movement. And of course, Confucius or Confucianism did not gain favor with Communist Party until very recently. In the 1970s, Confucianism was again denounced. It was quite strange that the Communist Party decided to attack somebody who's been dead for more than 2,000 years. But in the last 5 or 6 years, the Communist Party leadership was keenly aware of the need to, as I said, fill China's intellectual void, but more importantly, to counter the what they perceive as Western ideological offensive, namely democracy, liberalism, human rights.
So you see Confucianism as a kind of barrier or put up as a barricade against those, democracy, liberalism, human rights?
Well, to some extent, because Confucianism, as your previous guests have said, do contain an anti-democratic element. Confucianism justifies, rationalizes the existing order rather than denouncing it. I think that's part of the political motivation behind this ideological resurrection of Confucianism.
Xu Dongchang in New York,
yeah.
How about it? This is a kind of barrier to Western thought.
Well, no, I kind of disagree. If you think Confucianism can function as a state ideology, then look at South Korea or Singapore. I mean, in these places, Confucianism is much more pronounced and more state-sanctioned, and sort of there's more structural kind of a presence of Confucianism, much more so than in China today. I guess even if the government intends to do that, to imitate those practices of so-called Confucian capitalist society, mm-hmm. it might not be able to succeed because China is just too vast, and too complicated, too uneven. I think this our premise is a little misguided, if I may say so. I think instead of looking, asking whether Chinese Communist Party is using Confucianism as a way to legitimate itself mm-hmm. or to fend off Western ideological offenses, I think we should also look at the Chinese contemporary Chinese economic, social life, everyday life. I think there's a sense. I think the surging back of Confucianism, if that's true, mm-hmm. I think it will have to do with a general sense of being more or less at home, certainly more at home than several decades ago, the increased wealth and the social freedom, to the extent that the ordinary Chinese may now be in a position to wonder what's the purpose of life, what's the meaning of life, and what's the kind of life I want to lead and I want my kids to lead. Mm-hmm. So these, I think, provide the larger context of Confucianism coming back as one of the many ingredients thrown into the mix.
Let's bring our listeners in here, if I may. Virginia Beach, Virginia. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question and thought is this. This isn't the first time we've seen this happen.
The Third Reich did it with bringing Nietzsche's philosophy and Wagner's artism to bear to justify their regime. So why are we surprised that a repressive or you know, some people consider a repressive Chinese regime would do the same thing to try to legitimize itself?
Min Ching Pei, do you see a repressive regime using philosophy and the arts to legitimize itself here or not?
Well, there's, as I said, there is an element of this. I'm quite uncomfortable when a government gets into the business of promoting a certain kind of philosophy. Especially in the case of China, we've seen this happening in history repeatedly. That's why I'm fully aware that there is a societal embrace of Confucianism out of its own need for cultural enrichment or the ideological need. I'm completely vigilant about government's involvement in this kind of ideological campaign.
Vigilant, suggesting that you're what, skeptical or suspicious of its use?
Alert about the political consequences of this, because Xu Dong talked about the cultural, the social context in which Confucianism made a comeback. I'm aware of the political context in which Confucianism became a favorite of the Chinese government, because, as I said, in recent years, government, or at least some elements in the government, are very resistant to Western ideas, to liberalism, and they think Confucianism can play the role of obstructing the power, or the blunting the power of the appeal of Western liberalism.
Du Weiming, what's your view? Do you see this as something that might blunt Western liberalism, that might actually be a barrier to democracy developing in China?
I think I strongly disagree with Pei Mingxin's second part of his assessment, even though I think the first one is more nuanced. Mm-hmm. Now, let's look at the Goethe Institute or the Cervantes Institute. They were supported by governments.
These are cultural outposts of the
absolutely.
German government, the Spanish government.
Yeah.
There's the Alliance Française.
Absolutely. Or the American soft power.
Mm-hmm.
So if you embrace a great mind,
You're saying every country projects its traditional philosophies into the world.
Yeah. Let's say Karl Jaspers in 1948 talk about the four great paradigmatic personalities shaping human history for centuries: Socrates, Jesus Christ, Buddha, and Confucius. That's the consensus of some of the most brilliant minds, and Confucianism was very important as a reference in the 17th, 18th century for great Enlightenment thinkers such as Voltaire, Leibniz, Kinney, Diderot, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you look at Confucianism as the habits of the heart of not only Chinese but East Asians as a whole, or as some people say, cultural DNA, I think that's probably more exaggerated. And therefore, I think I agree with Zhang Xudong that the resurface of Confucianism has a great deal to do with China's new sense of cultural identity. And of course, the cultural identity can be closed, monotheistic, but it can also be open, self-reflexive, and pluralistic. So I think it's a side of contention. I would say the side of contention is being appropriated by various kinds of forces, by the government, by the people. For example, we have 340 million so-called net people, Wangming, in China.
Internet users.
Internet users.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the kind of studies, the kind of reflections, there's no question about the fact now, overwhelming, if not majority, overwhelming intellectual scholars begin to look at Confucianism in a more disinterested way on the one hand and more sympathetic way on the other. In other words, it's a real rejection of the Maoist ideology with emphasis on struggle, emphasis on revolution at all expense. Right now, partly because of marketization, China needs more harmonious relationships between the extremely rich and the poor, the coastal line and interior, all these features that define China's market society seems to suggest another broad sense of humanistic and spiritual self-cultivation becomes, if not irresistible, becomes very important resource, not just for the government, for its emphasis on stability, but for the Chinese people or even East Asian people in general.
Xudong Chang, clearly we need to draw on the wisdom of the whole world, and we've been through a period where the West was very dominant. Now, if Confucianism comes back or rises with China, talk about harmony. Does that look like a path toward harmony to you or a path toward conflict? You know, Samuel Huntington, who, of course, you know, made the clash of civilizations his hallmark, but back in 96, he was describing a Confucian world with China at its center, finding itself in growing conflict with the West. Does the rise of Confucianism help us settle that conflict? Does it make a conflict inevitable? How do you look at it?
It's an excellent question. I would say harmony can only be achieved through conflict. Hopefully, that's a manageable conflict, productive conflict. And Confucianism is certainly capable of that, I would say. And along with Confucianism, there's also the surge of development of, say, rural Christianity in China, the Buddhism, you know. There are just lots of different, sort of areas or pockets of revived sort of cultural and semi-religious or intellectual activities. I think that's generally a positive tendency. Could I drop in a little anecdote? You mentioned the Wei Ming's Institute. And at the same time, Peking University, which is my alma mater, also established a Center for Critical Theory, which I'm heading. It's not only the center's mission is to promote critical thinking, but it's also doing it in a highly international way. We have mirror institutions in New York, in Tokyo, and we're developing partners in Europe. I don't think the Peking University is a state university. Is intentionally playing Wei Ming, pitching Wei Ming against me, but rather it could be a synergy in very different approaches, and if the state university can be used as an example, then I certainly hope. I mean, there's the Chinese society in general, at least Chinese intellectual life in general. Could be something like that. I'm not saying this is perfect already. There's still censorship.
But could be multifaceted. If you'll forgive me, I want to get another call here. Taita calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Yeah. Taita, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I always want to contribute to your thought-provoking program. This is some thought to provoke some comment. I agree with the previous speaker that the Chinese government want to pick and choose what they can use from Confucianism, such as harmony as a way of life, or authoritarianism as a political system principle, and then cultural identity. I have written about Confucianism both in China and Vietnam. One paper was presented in Hanoi. They have a very big conference in Hanoi on Confucianism, attended by Professor Wang Mingdu, whom I met there too. My question is this. They have used those specific tenets of Confucianism, but there's one more tenet that we have not discussed, the rule of law under Confucianism. Have they talked about the rule of law that Confucianism promote? Officials have to abide by the law. Each one of them has to have one book of law, the code, next to them.
It's a very good question. Our time is so short. Let us pick it up. Min Xingpei, how about it? Is the Chinese Communist Party picking and choosing from Confucianism?
Definitely. It picks what it likes and does not talk about what it doesn't like. By the way, I do not believe that Confucianism champions the rule of law. It's a rule by benevolent rulers rather than the rule by the law, which boils down to
limited government and constraints on the use of power. I want to add a few things.
We've just got half a minute, so...
Yeah, Professor Tu said that other governments also sponsor various cultural institutes. Mm-hmm. So let's not forget that other governments are democratic governments. The Chinese government is not. Mm. And democratic governments and authoritarian governments think very differently in the areas of cultural politics. And if you look at the current revival of Confucianism, you see one thing quite absent, that is critical thinking about Confucianism. It's a one-sided discussion. And so harmony as rhetoric is very different from harmony as politics, because the Chinese government has been very talkative about harmony, but in its practical policy, there is nothing harmonious.
Minxin Pei, with that, we're out of time, but you have all helped us crack open a new understanding. I'm sure it won't be the last we hear about Confucius in this century. Minxin Pei at the Carnegie Endowment, thank you for joining us today, and Xudong Chang at NYU in New York. Du Weiming, I'm very grateful to you for coming in. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.